TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The term TUC comes from a pilot's handbook. Time of Useful Consciousness is the time from the beginning of oxygen deficiency to the loss of consciousness, the time to save the plane. Today's program was recorded at the San Francisco airport. It is an interview with the Norwegian philosopher, ecologist, and farmer, Sigmund Qualøy. He had spoken at a conference on the protection of the last remaining wild places. There he had also introduced his most recent work and his grave concern, biological pollution by trade and the invasion of ecosystems by foreign species. There had not been enough time at the meeting to describe this in more detail, so I offered to drive him to the airport to hear more. We sat in the international terminal, waiting for his flight to Norway, among the bustle of arriving and departing flights. There he told me about the global travels of tiger mosquitoes, zebra mussels, influenza viruses, and fire ants, as they hitchhike rides across the globe inside used tires or in the ballast water of large ships. They may take over the new environment or spread diseases for which no immunity exists. I started out by asking Sigmund Qualøy about his family farm. I decided to let you hear what he told me because the contrast between his home life and the work he does could not be bigger. And I believe in some way that influences his thinking and his values. Qualøy is a philosopher, author, and ecologist, but he continues to work as a farmer. Here is Sigmund Qualøy at the San Francisco airport.
I'm a farmer. I live on my mother's family farm. I'm the 11th, probably the 15th generation on it. And it's in middle Norway. And most of the farm is forest. 200 hectares of spruce and birch.
What does the farm look like?
It's a very old farm. And it's got altogether 16 buildings. There used to be many more than that, but they have been deteriorating and fallen down. So in the home yard around where I live, there are 8 buildings, and the other ones are at 2 out farms, one in the forest, one in the mountains, where they used to move their cows during the first part and then the middle part of the summer. And there are some little hay barns here and there in the forest where they used to cut the grass with the scythe and store it for hauling home in winter time. My oldest building is a barn with very heavy timber in its walls, and it's at least 350 years old. And the house I live in is 250. It's also a timber building with a sod roof, grass on the roof, and so on. I think it's a kind of farm where the buildings are blended into nature very much, and the nature around it is very lush. And we have different trees close to the farmhouse. There's a tree we call hegg in Norway. It's full of white flowers in the spring. It smells very beautifully, and it gets small blackberries that are very good to eat.
In addition to farming, you do a lot of research, and your most recent research is about the transmission of all kinds of organisms via international travel and trade.
There's a tremendous rise in the number of different organisms that are thrown around the world from ecosystems where these organisms are in balance with the environment, with other organisms, and don't do much harm, to entirely foreign ecosystems, I mean foreign to these organisms that have been transferred by airplane or by cargo ship and so forth, and where they don't have natural enemies and where they cause sometimes very large damages, and sometimes we talk about catastrophes where a lot of the local organisms are just disappear. So this is the worst threat to the biodiversity of the Earth. I think this is the worst threat. Most people are not don't know anything about this. And the organisms in question are everything from prions, you know, the ones that give cow madness, to virus, bacteria, parasites, like the malaria parasites, for instance, and to fungi of different kinds that attack all kinds of living beings, too, and jellyfish and various kinds of tiny organisms in the oceans that are transferred very often with the ballast water in big tankers and bulk ships, and up to larger organisms too, like mammals that are carried into the wrong place and eat lots of other animals that used to live in peace there. I would say the enormous rise in this and the enormous damage that is happening is a direct consequence of globalization, of economic globalization. And the whole point of globalization is, of course, to increase the global trade and travel, transfer of goods, money, and so forth and so forth, tremendously. And so in order to achieve that, they are getting rid of border controls and actually getting rid of any kind of control that used to be with the national nation state. And so I would say that we are in for something really terrible that those people don't know anything about. You might say that this is creating ecological chaos. We are mixing the different local ecosystems. We speak about chemical pollution and biological pollution, and what I'm talking about here is biological pollution. And biological pollution is much worse than chemical pollution. Chemical pollution you can, in principle, often reverse. You can clean out the chemical. You can never do that with living material, because it you cannot pick out again bacteria and fungi. It's very, very difficult. And virus, of course, and so forth. You can never pick them out again, and they will start interacting with other organisms like a fan in all directions and change the ecosystem. And sometimes this has a long time delay before it's detectable. Like we have seen organisms that were transferred into a different continent 20 years ago and nobody knew about it. Then suddenly you have a population explosion in that organism after 20 years. So you cannot predict this. It's impossible to predict the consequences. And the thing that makes it worse is that you have one organism, an alien organism, invading your ecosystem and weakening it. Then you have another transfer of another kind of organism that, on top of that, that makes it even weaker. So you create vulnerability on one stage after another, and finally you may have almost like a collapse in the cases of isolated islands. You may have a total collapse of the local life-caring system. So this is extremely, extremely dangerous. And we are dealing here with the health of plants, animals, like our farm animals, and directly our own health, our own human bodies. Let me take a couple of examples. For instance, some few years ago, there was a transfer of the so-called Asian tiger mosquito from Japan to the United States and also later on to Africa in big shipments of used tires. These tires have been on the pier in some port in Japan, and it's been raining. There's a little bit of water in each tire, and so the local mosquito will breed there. And you store all those tires in containers and bring them in safety to the other continent where this insect has never been. And it's spread now in the northern jungles of South America, in the U.S. and so forth. And what is dangerous about this is that the Asian tiger mosquito is a much more effective carrier of the yellow fever virus, which we still have in monkey populations in the jungles of South America and in Africa. And there's very, very little vaccine for yellow fever. And you see, yellow fever is one of the terrible infections. It has a death rate of up to 50%. And it used to kill hundreds of thousands of people, even in Europe and North America, a century ago. Then we thought we had eradicated it, and we have been spraying the marshes with DDT and other chemicals to get rid of the malaria mosquito, and also the yellow fever mosquito. Those are different mosquitoes, you see. And those mosquitoes have built up resistance, and so spraying doesn't help anymore. And on top of that, you get a transfer of the Asian tiger mosquito to a continent where it doesn't have any natural enemies either. The few researchers who are expert on this, they are very, very nervous now, because they say that it's enough with one infected person in South America flying to New Orleans on a plane, and you will have a spread of this infection, and in a matter of a week or two, 10,000 people may be dead. So this is just one illustration. Another illustration that I guess many people in the U.S. know about is the infection of the Great Lakes by the Euro-Asian zebra mussel, which is clogging up all the different water lines. And it costs like $1 billion every year to clean that out, and you can't get rid of this organism. And there was recently a transfer into the Florida Everglades of an Asian swamp eel that is spreading extremely fast, and making it, you know, impossible for the local fishes to find nutrients, or just eating a lot of the local organisms too.
Do you know how the eel and zebra mussel got into the Great Lakes and the Everglades?
The zebra mussel got into the Great Lakes through the ballast water in big ships, and probably the swamp eel too, which is an Asian creature. I can't think of any other reasonable explanation. It came through ballast water. And this is actually the form of transfer that people know least about. A big tanker is starting out, let's say, from Huanghu, the Yellow River in northern China, which has more or less the same climate as southwestern Norway. And it's heading for Norway to load oil. We have a very big oil drilling business on the west, in the ocean west of Norway. We are actually the second largest oil exporter in the world after Saudi Arabia. And this ship takes in ballast water. You see, when a big tanker or a bulk ship is crossing the oceans empty, because it's going to get a load of something at the other port, it cannot go empty, because if there's a storm, it will capsize. So what they do, they pump an enormous amount of water into special tanks or just into the hulls of these ships, and it may be up to 100,000 tons of water. In most cases, those ports are at the estuary of a very biologically rich rivers with an enormous amount of different organisms. So they go into the ballast water. And modern ships with big tanks and going quite fast, the chance of these organisms surviving is very great. So this ship arrives at a western oil port in Norway, and it will let out the whole mass of ballast water, which contains thousands of different organisms, as little as virus. We have seen, not in Norway, but we have seen in the Gulf of Mexico, for instance, that a virus was transported from the Pacific Ocean through the Panama Canal, and it created the largest, most widespread death of an organism where I don't know the English name. It's a it's an animal. In Norway we call it kråkebolle, which means a crow ball. It's a round. It's an animal. It's a round shell on the outside with nice colors and so forth. It's dying off from this virus. Similar things on seals in the Mediterranean. And I have been talking with the Norwegian Maritime Research Institute a lot about this, and they agree with me that there is a very big risk here. You see, we are a big oil exporter, but we are also the biggest exporter in the world of cultured fish. I mean fish from fish farms. You have fish farms all along the western and northern coasts of Norway, directly in the same areas where the big oil tankers come. The export value of cultured fish from Norway is almost as big as from the oil. It's those two big pillars of Norwegian economy now threaten, so to speak, threaten the one threatens the other. So we might get an infection on the salmon or in the fish ponds along the Norwegian coast of an entirely foreign organism. So it might be a catastrophe. There's another very interesting example of the transfer of an earth flatworm from New Zealand some years ago by some shipment with a little bit of soil, so the eggs are transferred, you see, and it took hold in Ireland. And this organism starts behaving in the European environment in an entirely different manner from its home environment in New Zealand, where it has natural enemies. So in Europe, it eats all the earthworms. It makes a completely clean slate. It eradicates the earthworm. And this flatworm does not have the functions of the earthworm, you know, in transferring nutrients between the different layers in the soil and keeping the soil porous and airy and so forth and so forth. So it went from Ireland to Scotland, even to the Orkney Islands, and it's now as far south in England as London and even further. And in the area where it has been going, doing its thing the longest, in Ireland, the soil is hard as concrete and you can't grow anything there. And I could go on and on. The Argentinian fire ant, which is in Argentina, each hive has one queen. And if you open the hive, you see that there are other little organisms then together with the ants, keeping them in check. So the fire ant was transferred to Florida through a shipment of some kind, and it's spreading very fast, and it's been spreading now the last few years throughout the United States. They are able to, if there's a flood, they're able to build floats and transfer themselves hundreds of kilometers. And if you open a fire ant hive in the U.S., it might have as many as 20 or even more queens in the same enormous hive. And there's no other organisms except fire ants. So they have no check. Nothing is checking them. And in some U.S. ecosystems, they have reduced the diversity by 75%. 75% of the different small and bigger organisms, they even kill birds, have been eradicated from those ecosystems. I think it's high time that there are campaigns now to enlighten people about this. I can't explain how bad this is to you in a few words. As I said before, one stress comes on top of the other, and the ecosystems are weakened. I think this is, and we might have pandemics. Part of the picture is the creation of the very frequent now creation of new influenza or flu viruses. You might have noted that the new viruses, new influenza viruses, have the names after big cities, big fast-growing cities, like the Hong Kong, the Beijing, the Johannesburg, and so forth. And this is because the big and fast-growing cities of the world are the main center, so to speak, for the creation through mutations and so forth of new varieties of organisms. And that's where they are able to grow tremendously, because people and dogs and rats and so forth live very close together and very often under dirty conditions. And so they spread very quickly through the jet plane. For instance, the Beijing influenza virus is a new variety where the old vaccines don't work. So it starts in Beijing, goes quickly, it goes by jet plane to Australia, from there to the US, from there to Europe, and finally to Norway, and finally hits me at the Setring farm, and I was in bed for 3 weeks. Of course, one very important element here is modern industrial tourism. Only last year, almost one-fifth of every inhabitant, human inhabitant of this earth was a tourist. And, of course, modern tourism is conducted by big like industrial companies, you know. They are in stiff competition with each other. So in order to outcompete or to keep yourself from being outcompeted, you have to shuffle the largest amount of people, the quickest and easiest possible way across borders, and you are interested in arranging so that they may lead more or less wild life in the cities or on the beaches where they go, and then as quick as possible back. You know, because the wilder life the tourist leads, the more money that person will leave too. Many of these new tiny organisms that we have never registered before seem to be the outcome of the destruction of the last dense jungles in the tropics, and through nuclear radiation, which increases the mutation rate and so forth, and chemical pollution. And we know that it in many cases has created mutations and destroyed the old stability established over millions of years in micro ecosystems. So in some cases we see that new types of viruses, like the Ebola virus in Africa, appear. One theory is that this is an outcome of the destruction of forested areas and nuclear radiation from the fallout from the time when they were testing bombs in the high atmosphere and so forth. In the Ebola virus district in Zaire in Africa, there is a very high content of strontium-90 in the soil. So you see, in the micro ecosystems, you might have had the dominance of so-called DNA virus, which has a double check on its life cycles. And instead of that, you get the dominance of so-called RNA virus, which mutates at a rate of 100 times as fast as the DNA virus. And, of course, the Ebola virus is that kind. And, of course, the Ebola virus has a death rate of about 90. So some people say it will kill off its prey, so to speak, so it won't spread. But that doesn't hold if that person who has been infected goes by airplane, like to New York City, and goes around in various restaurants and bars and visits people and so forth and so forth. In this an enormous agglomeration of people. So there's one famous Danish pathologist. He used to be the head of the Association of Criminal Court
Forensic Medicine.
Yes, yes. So he has written a book called Lualaba. Lualaba is another African river close to the Ebola. And his argument is really very compelling. He's taking in data from which is very interdisciplinary from many fields. And he thinks that, maybe I shouldn't say this, but he's been, of course, criticized by many biologists too, but he says that he thinks that inside of a span of 100 years from now, mankind might not exist because of the spread of those kinds of new virus. He thinks that the new virus is the worst menace. So why I keep talking about this and why I'm writing about this is that I try to say that the only effective remedy against this kind of future is to cut down drastically on world trade, especially global trade, because the worst effect you get when you transfer an organism over great distances, because the greater is the chance that you get to an ecosystem that is radically different from the one where you go. So local trade, you know, like inside Scandinavia, is much less of a danger. But global trade, like the ballast water example and so forth, is much worse. So I think we finally will be forced into that, to cut down drastically on world trade. And of course, there are other good arguments for cutting that down because of the climate change we are experiencing. So we have to cut down on air traffic and on the traffic of big ships and so forth, and auto traffic on land because of the pollution, CO2 and so forth, other climate gases that is produced. And the other point, to re-establish very strong border controls and to cut down on international tourism is part of this. And these are economies that are destructive in any case for local economies. I think I have to go.
That was Sigmund Qualoy, a philosopher, ecologist, author, and farmer. He lives in the mountains above Trondheim, Norway, on land that has been in his family for 11 generations. He's a member of the International Forum on Globalization. I recorded him inside the international terminal of the San Francisco airport. You can get this talk with Sigmund Qualoy from TUC Radio for $12. Your tape order helps support our work. The tape that you will get includes last week's program on biotechnology with Andy Kimbrell. For a credit card order, call us anytime, toll-free, at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening.